session number 9428, reel 12.
Mr. Keel, reel 12. You were describing a song that was extremely popular when you were in the concert party. Perhaps you could sing the verse of it for
us. Well, the concert party I think we're talking about is the one at Tankerton, where, yes, about being popular, some songs really caught on. Now, I had one song. The audience would let me do my two numbers. You know, you do two single numbers. And then that's it, you know, you go off and somebody else goes on and does their act. But not me. I should think 8 times out of 10, as soon as I'd finished my second number, the audience would start. Om bom pong, om bom pong, om bom pong. And so it would keep on until, well, you had to do it. Or you had to get up and say, stop it, you people. Will you? No, so I had to do it. Om bom pong was just one of those senseless Anglo-French songs, en bon pont, of course, which you know, but perhaps future generations won't know what it means. En bon pont is a French word for a very fat tummy, en bon point. But it's pronounced in English, French, en bon pont. And I can remember one verse of it, if you'd like to hear it.
Yes, please do.
I haven't got any music, of course, it was the opening verse, of course. As I pass along this way, I look in to say good day, just a compliment to pay to the brilliant throng. People, as I pass along, say très bon, bon ton, regardez-vous, en bon pon. En bon pon is me. That's it. About four verses of it, I think. That's the only one I can remember.
And that received tumultuous applause.
Well, yes, they let me do it, and that was it. They were satisfied. they had to have their ration of en bon pont.
Okay, thank you very much.
It was the same in the war years. I told you that I played the song that was prior to en bon pont was Tommy Onglet, where they'd let me go, but always I had to repeat Tommy Onglet, Tommy Onglet. And en bon pont took its place at Tankerton.
Right, thank you. What did you do after your seasons at Tankerton?
I can think of one or two funny little things at Tankerton stage. Tankerton stage was a very small, very low stage. And when you've got to learn about 100 items to run you through the season, a lot of it won't sink in. Now, I hit on a brainy idea, which everybody followed me, was that in the concerted numbers, that is, you've each got a line, and you usually do it by walking round in a sort of queue, an unending queue. And so that I used to write my words on the palm of my hand in ink. If I was wearing a top hat, I would put it inside the bottom of the hat and take my hat off every once in a while and look at it. I've even written them on the silver knob of my stick, with sticking plaster. But this greatest one was by putting it written quite large in the footlights, see? And so everybody pinched the same idea, and they all put their line that they had to say in the footlight, knowing just when you're going to pass that point. Well, that worked very well, except that the stage was so low, and the people, when they came in for the front row, had to pass the footlights, and they could look down on the footlights. And one very clever son of a gun, one night as I came in, just switched the bits of paper over from left to right and right to centre and centre to the other end. And so we're all ready, and we started off with our march round and sing, and we couldn't find our flaming words. They'd shifted them. That caused great fun. Another funny thing happened there But my wife had a rather extra large mouth, and she was in the summertime. She was singing something. It finished up with a high note. The mouth was open like a very great trapdoor. But anyway, she was very pretty. But she opened her mouth wide for this last note. Just as she did that, I was watching her face. I saw one of those daddy long leg flies. It flew right across the stage, and it flew straight into her mouth. She splattered and spat. She got rid of it. they were sort of one of those daddy long legs. I used to do a funny thing with daddy long legs. I used to catch one when nobody knew it and hold it loosely in my left hand, and then suddenly stand up when we were sitting around what I call a sit round. I would suddenly stand up and watch one of these daddy long legs come along and grab it quickly, and everybody saw me catch it. Then I used to stand and I used to waggle my shoulders like that and put my arms out like that, and then open the hand that they saw me catch the thing, which I got rid of. And I opened my hand and there's nothing there, and I opened my left hand and I flew the thing. Of course, it's the one I caught beforehand. That used to cause a great, great bit of fun.
Did you do that on stage? Or was
on stage, just for the people to see. And one rude one I can remember that happened there was, yes, we were so near the audience, you see, and we were so low down on them that something, some little thing I had to say or do, and I had to bend down to pick up something. And as I bent down, I must have had baked beans the night before, because I suddenly backfired very loudly, all confused, and tried to cover it up by going, but people knew very well what it was. They knew I'd backfired, and whatever I couldn't cover it up, but boy, I did feel small. They thought it was funny. I didn't.
How many seasons did you play at Tankerton altogether?
Oh, I don't know.
You were there for several years, were
you? Oh, yes. Yes, we were there. I should think 5 or 6 years.
And during that time, presumably, you returned to your wife as well, because she was...
Well, we lived there. No, we lived there. She was always in the show. She was with the show there.
I understood that you actually departed when you went to America and you came back.
Oh, well, it was when I came back from America we'll make another go of it, and we did. Hence the daughter, which I have.
I see. And what happened after the Tankerton seasons ended altogether? What did you do then?
Business, the concert party shut down. Variety was dead. Entertainment was very dead.
Why was that?
Pictures, talking pictures, radio and television had just started, and that knocked out live human entertainment. There was just nowhere to go to play. I was starving to death at one time with 3 children and owing money all over the place. Merely because you couldn't get into a show, you couldn't find a variety date anywhere to play.
I believe at some time that you actually did work in radio. You just mentioned radio a moment ago as being a cause of variety perhaps going into decline.
Yes, variety. Variety on the air, do you mean? Or
I believe it was at 2LO, is that
that's correct? Right, yes. Well, I only did 1 or 2 shows there. That was with my boss, who ran the Tankerton show that I was talking about some time ago. He was Wireless Willie, and he used to put on little concert party shows there. He did several of them with him. It's the same as doing a concert party, except that you're not seen. But I didn't click to what I was doing, my French things, which I don't think interested the ordinary public.
Why not?
I don't know, but I remember once doing a bit of patter before my song. It was a French song I was going to sing, and so I would keep the French accent, and I said, "It is when I came along here this morning, I come up to the up to the broadcast, to the, what do they call it, the house, the Hill of Cabbages. What is the, what is a Hill of Cabbages? Hill of Cabbages? Oh, Savoy Hill, yes, Savoy Hill. I came to Savoy Hill. And then I did a little French song. But you don't know whether you're going over big or whether you're flopping or whether they've switched off or what. You don't know because you've got no reaction from anybody. The studio is empty. It's just a stocking great microphone in the middle of it. And there was nothing else. And in those days, the announcer had to wear evening dress. Not like today.
Were you expected to wear formal dress?
Oh, no, I had to wear even tails. Oh, yes. Yes.
You mentioned the studio is a very large place with a big microphone.
No, some were very small.
The one that you performed in, was what was that like?
Well, some were medium, some were small. I can remember one little item. She was, I wish I could remember her name, but a very well-known lady. I think she was a funny woman, I'm not sure, but a very lovely lady. And she was so terribly nervous that she wanted to hang on to, she wanted a chair that she could hold. And she was juggling with her feet, you know, with her toes and whatnot. And she caught her heel in the flex that led to the microphone. And in her wobbling her foot about, she pulled out the plug. And of course, everything went dead on the air, which they very quickly found. And I know we all had to dash from that studio, which was on about second or third floor. We all had to dash down to the basement to the other studio. And I can remember to this day the announcer saying, "Oh, sorry for the delay, ladies and gentlemen, but I went to a technical hitch over which we had no control. We were just a little bit off the air. But here is Lizzie Stinkbag again."
So it was obviously live when you were performing. It wasn't recorded.
It was live.
Can you remember what you felt at the time when you were broadcasting? Were you conscious of the
size
of the audience?
Yes, I can. I would much sooner do two or three shows than I would do a broadcast. You were conscious that you were being heard, you were being listened to by millions of people. Whereas in variety or concert party, they were in hundreds or less than hundreds. But on variety, broadcasting, you were scared of millions. If you made one little slip of the tongue, everybody, the whole world, heard it. And that's what you were very conscious of and very nervous about.
How many times did you broadcast?
I don't know. It's every time Willie Rouse put on one of his sort of concert party things, I was there doing something. If it was only a double act or... I don't know. I kept no record of those things in those days.
Were you well paid for it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we got more than much more than a guinea. A guinea was supposed to be a good price for things.
Was it more lucrative working for the concert party at Tankerton?
No, that wasn't too good. That was only about £10 a week. No. You know, when you were doing plenty, you were doing sometimes two shows a night, or if not two, you do one show a night and two matinees during the week.
You mentioned earlier on that it became increasingly difficult to get jobs in the theatre. Can you remember, roughly speaking, what year we'd be talking about when that started to happen?
Yes, let me see now. The war started. In 39, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
39. At least 4 years before that, 39, 30. I should say, as near as anything, 1935. 34, 35, I started the tiling because I couldn't do anything else. I couldn't find a show anywhere. And living next door to me was a builder, Rigby, nice man. He was living next door to me, and he really liked me and remembered me so well because he used to be one of my fans. And one morning, I don't know, we met outside our houses, and he said, "What's the matter, Tom?" He said, you look miserable." I said, I'm very broke, Bert, and I can't find a show anywhere, And what I want to do now, I said, I have learnt all about tiling. But he said, you're a funny man. I said, I know, but I had learnt about tiling years ago. Have you got any tiling in these new buildings you're putting up? Yes, he said, I've got tiling in every one. I said, would you like to give me a chance? Yes, he said, there's a house just down there that wants a bathroom and a kitchen tiled. Give me a price for it. I said, okay. Well, now, I hadn't got two halfpennies. So my father-in-law, who was a stingy, well, he's dead now, I won't say anything about him. I said, would you let me have some tiles and I'll pay for them now. You've borrowed money off me before, I've never got it back. That attitude. I said, well, I've got a house to tile and he won't pay me until it's finished. So if you like, if you won't let me have the tiles now, I will give him your name to forward to give you the check when the house is done. All right, I said, on that, when it's finished, I'll send in the bill as if it was my job. I said, good enough. Well, I'd only done half the bathroom, and the builder saw it, and he said, that's jolly good work. He said, you can have the house next door as well. And from those two houses, other builders in Tankerton and Herne Bay heard about Tommy Keel, a wonderful tiler. And I never troubled about show business anymore. I just built on my tiling thing. And then my name must have spread because one of the big builders who had big estates everywhere, they approached me. So I was doing all the tile work, nearly all of it, all over the Canterbury, southeast of England. I think I had the majority of it there. Then these big people, Crouch Brothers, they said, we have a big estate at Brighton and another one at so-and-so and another one somewhere else. And if you'd like to give us a price, you can have all our work. I gave them the price and they were satisfied. And so I kept on. And then I started to employ men. And I was employing quite a number of men. Right up until the war. Well, of course, as soon as war came along...
Perhaps we could talk about the war in a moment.
Yes.
First of all, how did you feel about taking a job like tiling when your prime business had always been entertainment? Yes.
Well, they had to take it or they had to leave it. They had to take it or they had to leave it. I remember in the very early days, I had the front of a shop. They call it a stall board or something. That's the outside, down below, under the window. Some shops are not nicely tiled. And I had that job to do, and it was on the corner of where all the big noises of Tankerton, the businessmen, all had to go past there, and just a little way along was the railway station. And I used to watch these sons of guns coming along, but before they would get to anywhere near me, they would cross over to the other side of the road. I went past me over the other side of the street because they're not going to say, hello, Tommy, what are you doing here? One of them did. I said, I'm earning my living. Any objection? And
were you bitter at all by the change?
Of course I was hurt. You know, because I was wearing scruffy clothes. Naturally, I would as a workman, a trader. Perhaps dirty boots or dirty hands. But for them to walk past the other side of the road, where at one time they were so pleased to know Tommy Keel, and then they walked past me and not a word. Yeah. But when I started to grow up and I got these other estates to do, they all wanted to know me. But no. I said, when I was a scruffy tiler starting out on my own, you walked on the other side of the road. Now that I am the big Tommy Keel, you want to know me. I don't want to know you. And I never fraternised with anybody else again of the business world of Tankerton.
As a matter of interest, were you actually better off as a tiler than you were in the entertainment business?
Well, of course, it was a steady thing. I got money coming in every day, every week. Whereas you got a show to do, you play it and it's finished and you haven't got another one to follow on. No, no. Yes, the tiling was best. Harder work, of course, but I grew up to be my own boss and I was very happy, and I could employ lots of others. I brought my son, as soon as he left school, I brought him into it, and he was the most efficient tiler, and to this day he's had his own business, like me, from tiling.
Do you remember, roughly speaking, what your income was?
No, I don't know. I couldn't tell you, except that it allowed me to have a place to store a lot of my goods or tiles, and it also paid me to run my own car and another car to carry goods. So it must have been fairly comfortable. Except that it was, I don't know whether it is today, it was very cut price. Everybody wanted it as cheap as he could. Tiles used to cost, in those days, about 5 shillings a yard. That was 36 tiles. 36 tiles. And they were 5 shillings. Now, a tiler would want 4 or 6 or 5 shillings a yard to fix them. Well, when builders say, oh, you're charging too much, I can't go above 10 shillings. So I used to say, but 10 shillings just pays for the tiles and the tiler. Oh, well, that's up to you. You'll have to get them to cut it down or something, but 10 shillings for a guy. So I had to tell my men that don't waste time, don't break more tiles than you can help, and you'll be in work for a long time. But no, there wasn't. I can remember one place in up in London, Crouch thing at Morden. The man I made foreman, very good tiler, and he said, I used to go perhaps twice a week, travel down from Tankerton down to all my various jobs, and when I got into this bloke's bathroom, it was about 4/5 finished. Not quite, 4/5 finished. And I got a very trained eye. I could tell exactly how many tiles there were fixed, how many yards there was. And I said, say his name was Bill. I said, what else have you done today, Bill? Oh, just this, Governor. I said, yes, but you haven't completed the bathroom. No, very hard going. I said, why? In what way hard going? Suction isn't very good. So I got a tile and cement and put it on. I said, the suction's all right there. Yes, but a lot of cutting. I said, you've got no cutting under about a 2-inch piece, which is nothing. It all seems hard going. And I had only just left this bathroom, was walking along the passage, and I heard this tiler say to his mate, who I paid the mate as well, I have a rude word to say, if you'll excuse me, I'll say it quickly. I heard him say, as I got past, away from the door, he said, oh, fucking hell, should I earn money for him? That just finished me. That was a union man. And unions, in those days even, like today, said that they must charge so much and that they must not fix more than so many yards in a day. Well, evidently he'd reached his peak of 4.5 yards that we say he was supposed to do, and that was as far as he was going. He was just fiddling about after that. But the union says he could fix that lot, but no more. And that's what anyone else should he earn money for me. I went back and I said, well, why should you earn money for me? I said, if you're out of work, if you're sick, I pay you. I pay your fares from here to your door. I pay the labourer to fetch and carry for you. If tiles are broken accidentally or pinched, so many tiles are pinched, I said, I don't ask you for anything. I take all those things. And I said, sometimes the 10 shillings I get a yard for fixing doesn't pay me for all my things. I said, and that's why I said, from that, I think I sacked him some little while later, and I said I would never employ another union man. And to my knowledge, to this day, if anybody belongs to a union, I won't agree. I won't think. Though I belong to a union, still in my old age, I belong to Equity still. That is the actors' union. But I was so browned off with this chap that he could only do that and lose money for me all the time because he was a union man.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps we could now look at the events going on in the rest of the world whilst you were tiling away in the southeast of England.
Yes.
Had you any idea that war was approaching by the late 1930s?
Well, there was all this smell of war, wasn't there? There were, yes. You know, the Germans, they were invading Czechoslovakia. They were doing this, they were doing that, and it smelt very much as if a war was coming. So everybody, in a gentle way, were preparing for it. The same as Britain were preparing for it by thinking out this idea of the LDV, of which I joined at the beginning. It smelt like a war, and of course it developed into a war. And as soon as it became the war, I had joined this LDV before.
When did you join the LDV?
I should think... well, in that year that the war was in 39, wasn't it? I must have joined it at the beginning of 39 or the end of 38. But as I say, we weren't an army, but...
Yes, well, could you say what the LDV actually was?
Yes, the LDV, we used to wear an armband, and it was thought out that all veterans of the previous war would volunteer to serve. If another war broke out, they would volunteer to serve in the new army. So it was the local defence volunteers. And so as soon as the war was declared, well, actually, for quite a month or two before the war was declared, I was busy at, with a lot of my troops, busy at the big airport near Margate. I'll think of the name in a minute. I was there. We were guarding the aerodrome, Manston Aerodrome, the LDV. We were then in uniform. We were guarding that to see that no saboteurs came on the planes. We would put a guard on every plane, and so on. So I was there for quite a while. I should think many weeks, because I heard the war declared there. My two sons, who eventually both joined the Air Force, they came to see me, and we were sitting in our barrack room there in Nissen Hut, and they said there was a special thing coming on the radio, and so we heard war.